Thank you. Let's all be seated.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. I know we're starting a couple minutes early. Before we start, I wanted to ask, are we waiting for anyone? Is a client going to come? Or can we march on?
We are not waiting for anyone, Your Honor.
How about for counsel for the respondent?
We're ready to proceed, Your Honor.
Thank you so much. All right, then. Our first case this morning is A21-1669, EDF RE U.S. Development versus RES America Construction. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then the respondent. Okay, well, it's totally missing this. We haven't been in court for a long time, so I guess I've forgotten all the rules. Appellant will have 15 minutes. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone in the middle and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Is this loud enough?
It's perfect.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Hugh Brown from the Fabianski firm for appellant and cross-respondent EDF RE U.S. Development, LLC. I want to address 3 points this morning. First, invoices were not a condition to EDF's right to receive LDs, and the district court was wrong to hold otherwise. Second, the district court correctly held that RES does not have valid liens because it did not comply with statutory lien requirements. And third, district court correctly held that RES was not entitled to a time extension under the contract's force majeure provision. So moving to my first point. As this court knows, the parties included liquidated damages to be paid by RES if its work was late. The district court found that RES was late and that the liquidated damages provision was reasonable and enforceable. But then, despite these findings, the district court held that EDF was not entitled to recover these LDs because it had not sent RES an invoice for them. It relied on a single sentence for this conclusion, a timing provision, in an exhibit to the agreement, Exhibit A2. It provided no reasoning or analysis other than quoting this provision, and the decision was wrong for 3 reasons. First of all, it's inconsistent with the plain language of the provision on which the court relied. To say that damages become due and payable 7 days after receiving an invoice is simply not the same as saying that damages never become due and payable unless one receives an invoice. It's a basic logical fallacy. The language that the court relied on only means that EDF may collect on liquidated damages under the agreement within 7 days after sending an invoice.
But if no invoice, I mean, we've seen the 2 invoices, we've seen the letter. My question is whether we call it a condition precedent or anything else. How can RES be in breach of a contract if these delay liquidated damages have never become due and payable?
Your Honor, these liquidated damages became due and payable when RES was late. They accrued when RES was late.
Well, that may be true, but isn't there a difference between being entitled to recover something and having it actually due and payable?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, we can go to the second sentence of the provision on which the district court relied. That sentence said that liquidated damages must be paid upon substantial completion if they have not been paid already.
But I share Judge Bjorkman's concerns, and one concern I have is, there were several types of liquidated damages depending on what did or did not happen, and there were various categories. And one beneficial reason I see for the requirement of the invoice is depending on which section you're saying they didn't comply with in terms of timing, you know, the invoice, as some of the earlier ones did, gives the other side a heads up, okay, so it's this one, so maybe if you know it's this one, you can sort of speed up and do something for this one, as opposed to that one where, you know, where we're stuck, but we can sort of, you know, fix the things we have some control over. And why is that, why does that not make sense in your mind?
Your Honor, at every point during this project, RES had the ability to calculate to the penny how much it owed EDF in liquidated damages. It knew when it's...
Yeah, but if it's your job, why would they do that? I mean, I'm sure they knew time's a wastin', but again, by your saying which one is which, well, then maybe they could have done something for something.
They had a contractual obligation to meet every one of these milestones upon, on the date that the milestone was to come due. These dates were set out in the contract itself, and RES had an affirmative contractual obligation to meet these dates unless it was excused from that obligation because of force majeure, an owner delay, or some other excusable delay under the contract. So RES had an affirmative obligation to meet these dates and to pay liquidated damages if it did not. It is a... to say that these liquidated damages are not owed at all unless an invoice is sent.
Well, what's unfair about that? I mean, the language of Exhibit 2 specifically says due and payable when this happens. I mean, these are sophisticated parties.
The state Supreme Court has said that conditions precedent, and RES is characterizing this as a condition precedent, and so did the district court, must be expressed in clear and unequivocal language.
And isn't one of the ways to do that to use kind of, you know, the magic words, one of which is after?
RES relied on a single case to support the proposition that the word after was sufficient to create a condition precedent. That case did not actually cite the contractual language in question. We do not believe that that case stands for the proposition that RES is relying on it for.
So what... Go ahead. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Brown. I know you've got a lot of things to cover.
Sure. As I've already mentioned in response to one of your questions, RES's reading in the district court's holding ignores the subsequent sentence saying that all unpaid and accrued liquidated damages become due upon substantial completion. That language would have no function if those liquidated damages had already become due by the sending of an invoice. The district court's ruling renders that language meaningless. So does RES's argument. Those arguments also ignore the broader context of this language. As you pointed out, Your Honor, there are several provisions in the agreement saying that RES shall pay liquidated damages if it fails to meet one of these milestones. Those provisions do not contain provisos or conditions. I would suggest to you that if any sophisticated party wished to express that invoices were a condition precedent to their obligation to pay liquidated damages, they would say so in any provision that says we must pay liquidated damages. We would say unless we receive an invoice. It would be very poor contract drafting and not to do that.
What is the significance then of the sentence that does say that that the contractor is obligated to pay these damages, that they will be due and payable within 7 days after owner has invoiced contractor for such amounts? If, as you say, it really doesn't matter because this isn't an express condition precedent, then what do we do with that sentence?
Your Honor, the significance of that sentence is to avoid disputes as to whether these dollars are due before substantial completion. Liquidated damages continue to accrue between the missed milestone and the date on which that milestone is actually met. That language is intended to give EDF the right to start recovering those liquidated damages before RES has actually met the milestone and the full amount of liquidated damages can be calculated. EDF is allowed to continue to start collecting liquidated damages as they are accruing and continue to collect them up until substantial completion, at which point it may collect them all. So moving on from the interpretation of the contract, I would also point out EDF did send a letter and filed a complaint that is the functional equivalent of an invoice in every material respect. An invoice is a demand for payment. EDF's letter was also a demand for payment. So was EDF's complaint. The only difference is in formatting, and there's no principled reason why a letter or a complaint should have any different legal function than the invoice that Res is complaining it did not receive.
Although, you know, the letter you're referring to, the February 8th, 2019 letter, you know, that does seem very different from the two invoices you did send out, which seemed to kind of break it down a little bit and refer to the contract and discuss the scope of work and general requirements. And, you know, one of them even has a very, you know, pretty sketch on it. And the other one, you know, that kind of looks like an invoice. I guess, explain to me why the letter, which has one sentence, half of which deals with the demurrage charges, and just says $5,803,000 in liquidated damages. Do you really think that letter is an invoice?
I believe it serves the same function and operates in the same manner as an invoice. The agreement here did not provide any formatting requirements for an invoice, and the parties could have done that if they wanted to. It's common for complex construction contracts, as this court knows, to attach forms where they want to specify what forms ought to look like. They didn't do that here for these invoices. Since my time is ticking down, I want to move on to my next two topics. And actually, I want to jump to my third topic first.
May I ask you, if I may,
yes,
a question,
Your Honor.
Though, about the mechanics lien issue? I did have a couple on those. I'll
yes,
just
Your Honor.
Try and be brief. The district court found that Res wasn't entitled to additional compensation because it had already received full value for its work. You know, on appeal, they're saying, well, the case the district court cited for that doesn't stand for that proposition. Is there authority we can turn to for that proposition, or do we have to, you know, reach these ownership issues, which are a little more fraught?
Your Honor, we are not taking a position on the district court's ruling that because Res was not entitled to extra compensation, it's not entitled to a lien. That's not an issue that we're addressing here today. And so, unfortunately, that we may be sending you back to the ownership issues. All right, I want to talk about force majeure since my time is running low. We've covered the contract interpretation issues on this point extensively in our briefs, and I'm not going to repeat them all, of course, but I do want to point this out. The parties bargained for a specific threshold of rain, which would entitle Res to force majeure relief. They expressed it in the agreement in specific certain terms, and there would have been absolutely no reason to do this if they had not intended it to mean something. Under Res's interpretation, this 25-year, 24-hour standard is just one example of many, and it's bounded only by the extent of Res's imagination. If it can find some point of comparison between this and any other level of rain, Res would argue it is entitled to force majeure recovery under whatever example they choose to cite. I also want to point out that regardless, remand on this issue would be pointless because the lower court held on page 165 of her order, and as we pointed out in pages 5 and 16 of our response brief, Res failed to provide proper notice of its claim for time extension and delay. The district court found that Res didn't comply with its contractual notice requirements because it didn't provide an estimate of the impact of the force majeure events that it was relying on within the required 5 days. District court held that EDF was prejudiced by this late notice. That's on page 166 of the court's order. And it also relied on the Buckman Plumbing case, in which the Minnesota Supreme Court held that compliance with notice requirements is a condition for preserving a claim. And so even if this court were to agree with with Res that the district court's decision on the precipitation-based force majeure claim was wrong, remand would still be pointless because Res has also failed to meet its notice obligations. And turning to the lien, it's fundamental that a party cannot foreclose a lien without suing the party that owns the lienable interest. It is not disputed that Res did not sue the party that owns lienable interests in the turbines, in the land, that held the interest in the generator interconnect agreement or the power purchase agreement here.
How do you respond to the argument that you should be judicially estopped from asserting this, given the fact that your client has asserted an ownership interest in throughout this litigation? And you know, I went back and looked at the complaint and the amended complaint, and both times your client holds itself out as the owner and developer.
2 points, Your Honor. First, we raised the ownership interest in the discovery responses that we submitted. We also notified them of the error in our pretrial brief before trial, and then again the night before trial, and we offered them the opportunity to correct the mistake. They declined until it was too late.
Isn't that just counsel taking inconsistent positions in the course of litigation, which we have some case law that says that's what judicial estoppel can address?
Then let me move to my second point, Your Honor, which I believe responds to that. Ultimately, EDF does not agree with the accusations of sharp practice that RES has leveled here. But ultimately, it doesn't matter because under the Minnesota Supreme Court Dunham case, there can be no ownership or no foreclosure without actual ownership and without the foreclosing party proving what ownership interests the defendant holds. In that case, the plaintiff sued the wrong party. Unlike here, the defendant in that case flatly admitted ownership interests in the real property that it did not actually have. And unlike in this case, the defendant in that case didn't even try to correct the mistake. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court ruled for the defendant because without actual ownership, there is nothing for a sheriff to seize and sell, which is the purpose of a mechanics lien. It's not disputed that EDF has no actual ownership interest here and that there is nothing to seize and sell. Therefore, accusations of sharp practice aside, the Dunham case is dispositive, and the lower court did not commit error in rejecting Rez's lien. I see my time has elapsed.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, cross-appellant, please.
Thank you. May it please the court, James Hartnett from Fagery Drinker on behalf of Res America Construction. After more than 2 years of intense litigation in the district court, Res America Construction seeks affirmance of the district court's findings of fact and conclusions of law related to the party's contractual dispute, even though those findings and conclusions are only partially favorable to Res. Unlike appellant, Res recognizes that the selective reversal of particular findings and conclusions to flip the result without a new trial cannot be legally justified. The district court's contractual findings and conclusions should be affirmed because appellant was contractually obligated to invoice Res for claimed liquidated damages, and the district court awarded appellant all of the liquidated damages that it invoiced. Appellant's other affirmative claims also were properly rejected by the district court. On its cross appeal, Res seeks restoration of its mechanics lien rights, which the district court erroneously denied, so that Res can file a post-trial petition for costs and fees as permitted by Section 514.14 of the mechanics lien statute.
Mr. Hartnett, sure. That is one thing I just wanted to be clear, because you started out by saying you're seeking affirmance, but if we affirm, not saying that we will, on liquidated damages, do we still have to reach your mechanics lien issue? That was not as clear to me in your brief as kind of some of the other issues you raised in your
I mean, it is our position that the ruling invalidating our mechanics lien should be reversed to allow us to file a post-trial petition for fees and costs. That's all we're seeking to do, because we were awarded, you know, over $6 million as a successful mechanics lien claimant. Remembering, of course, that the appellant sued us, asking not only to keep the $6.7 million that it withheld, but asking for $4 million more. And my client, you know, had those contractual proceeds withheld for more than 2 years, and we believe that we are a successful mechanics lien claimant entitled to our statutory rights to seek fees and costs as a successful mechanics lien claimant. So that is the only relief that we're seeking, would be the restoration of our mechanics lien rights for the purposes of pursuing a post-trial petition for fees and costs as permitted by that statute. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
And mechanics lien, I mean, that's a statutory creation, and it hinges on ownership. And it seems to me it's undisputed in the record that after, I guess, July, October of 2018, EDF had assigned all of its interests to SPP.
Well, let me go directly to that point because...
And didn't you know that in your mechanics lien filings? I think SPP is listed as an owner, isn't it?
Well, here's the situation with regard to that. There were over 150 parcels of land covering 15,000 acres, and our client, was not interested, for example, in bringing dozens of farmers as defendants in a mechanics lien case. We had a dispute with our contracting counterparty, and we believed, based upon their complaint that they filed before our lien, where they said in unambiguous terms that it says EDF is the owner and developer of the project. That was their affirmative statement, and we believe, A, we were entitled to rely upon that, and furthermore, I take issue with Mr. Brown's contention that it is undisputed that the plaintiff has no ownership interest in this project. We do dispute that. And here's one of the reasons why. Mr. Brown cites Dunham Associates, the Minnesota Supreme Court case, but this is a quote from Dunham. Owner, as used in our mechanics lien statute, does not require proof of absolute ownership, but may include any interest which the court may order sold. Even an equitable interest may be reached if it is such that it may be sold. Now here, it is undisputed that appellant purchased the turbines, over $30 million worth of turbines. It was the owner of those turbines when RES began unloading them. RES's lien attaches to those turbines in addition to the land.
But they don't own them anymore. I mean, right? After
well, here's you know. The, if let me try to answer okay. that question. Because at trial, the only evidence of this alleged transfer of $30 million worth of turbines is a single piece of trial testimony. And that trial testimony, which can be found at, it's in the transcript at page 2005, starting on line 23 through 2006, line 1. The testimony is sometime after substantial completion of the project. Appellant assigned ownership interest of the turbines to an affiliate. Sometime after substantial completion was achieved in December of 2018. That is the only thing in the record to establish this alleged transfer. And when did the transfer occur? The record is unclear. It occurred sometime after substantial completion of the project in December of 2018. Sometime after, not a date certain, not any particular time.
But think,
go ahead, Judge Hart.
No, so you're arguing the district court erred by relying on that testimony?
The district court erred by relying on the finding of fact that misleadingly said, finding of fact presented by appellant, that misleadingly said that the transfer occurred in December, when in fact the trial testimony is that the transfer occurred sometime after substantial completion in December. I don't fault the district court for not going back to the transcript and checking the accuracy of the representations made by appellant, but that was appellant's position in its proposed findings, that the transfer occurred in December. But that's not what the trial record says. And moreover, there is not a single piece of documentary evidence in this case documenting that transfer. $30 million worth of turbines allegedly assigned to an affiliate of appellant, and there is no piece of paper documenting that transfer. All they have is a piece of testimony that says sometime after December. Well, our lien was filed sometime after December on April 15th, 2019. And I would submit that they... having represented their ownership interest throughout this litigation, from the first day when they filed their complaint all the way through the trial, for them to claim that that piece of testimony establishes beyond a doubt that they have no ownership interest, I don't think is supported by the record. I would like to turn to this question of judicial estoppel, because a question was asked about it. I mean, there was some... in our view, some substantial injustice in the way that appellant presented its positions at trial. Appellant filed two summary judgment motions. In the first summary judgment motion, it wrote, quote, that it is the It said, quote, Res contracted directly with the owner for purposes of 514.011. That is the pre-lien notice requirement, and therefore was required to provide pre-lien notice. The basis for its pre-lien notice assertion was that it had an interest in agricultural land. Res stands before this court, and appellant stands before this court and says that it never had a leasehold interest of any sort, and yet it sought and obtained a ruling from the district court that it was entitled to pre-lien notice. That is an assertion of a defense that is only available to a holder of an interest in agricultural land. And they not only insisted that they had that interest, and they obtained a ruling from the district court. It looks like you've got a question.
I do.
Okay.
So what Minnesota case could give us the best ground to apply judicial estoppel here? Because we have a lot of cases that say, not here, not there. Help us with that.
Sure. The Minnesota case that I believe most directly applies here is Port Authority of City of St. Paul v. Harstead, which is a Court of Appeals decision, 531 Northwest 2nd, 496. And this is a quote from Harstead. Judicial estoppel prevents a party that has taken one position in litigating a particular set of facts from later reversing its position when it is to its advantage to do so. It is intended to protect the courts from being manipulated by chameleonic litigants who seek to prevail twice on opposite theories. And here's why that applies here.
In that case, did that deal with sort of two different lawsuits or the same lawsuit?
I'd have to look at the facts of Harstead to get a better sense of what exactly was the issue of the judicial estoppel there. I confess I don't have it on the top of my head.
Generally, when we've applied it, it's when there have been two different lawsuits. You know, you can't say the light was green in the first one, and then, you know, the light was red in the second one. Following up to Judge Justin's excellent question, I mean, like it or not, they did sort of, the night before trial, you know, send you, I think it was the email or the letter.
Just a phone call.
Okay, fair enough.
But
So at that time, did you take the position of the district court that, oh, no, we're done. You know, you've already ruled on this, Your Honor. So they can't be doing this now. They're, you know.
Well, in the middle of prosecuting or defending against this trial, we filed a motion with seeking two forms of relief, I believe. One, that they should be stopped from these things. But also, if it was true that their affiliate was in fact the true record owner, then the affiliate should be joined as a party. And I want to follow up on...
What did the district court do?
The district court said that somehow it was prejudicial to join the affiliate, but I believe that, you know, in the cases that we cited in our brief, especially an affiliated, it's important to recognize here, we're not talking about some stranger, we're not talking about a farmer, we're talking about an entity wholly owned and controlled by the plaintiff. It has the same corporate offices. It has the same officers. When documents are being signed on behalf of the plaintiff and on this affiliate, the same person is signing the documents.
And Ress always knew that, right?
Well, the fact that those transfer documents, they were not produced to us.
No, but I mean the relationship between SPP and EDF was something everyone knew about, right? As you said,
yes.
They share.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact that they were affiliated entities, absolutely. But the contract was between, I mean, remember, they sued us. The contract was between this one particular entity and my client. But following up on this question of, well, you know, at the start of the trial, they told us that they changed their position. Even that's not correct. During the trial, the appellant sought more than $300,000 in leasehold-based damages, which the district court awarded. The testimony for those damages is found at pages 121 and 122 of the transcript. The plaintiff essentially said during the trial that it was entitled to recover those damages. It told the district court it was entitled to recover those damages because it had to pay additional amounts to the landlords, to the farmers. And the district court believed and accepted those claims and awarded the plaintiff those damages. It was only in its post-trial brief that the appellant dropped a footnote at page 24, it's footnote 7, And in that footnote, appellant says for the first time that those damages were actually incurred by these affiliated entities. And there we have the true injustice here. They brought those claims on behalf of their affiliated entities. They received a damage award from the district court for monies that are actually incurred by those affiliated entities.
And they didn't flow from the breach of contract?
Well, they allege that we were late and those were the reasons why. But now they claim, I mean, those damages were, under their theory, you know, they didn't own the land anymore, right? They never owned the land. These damages, that the direct cause of those damages is actually the tenant owes additional rent to the landlord. So it's only indirectly a claim that is somehow traceable back to us because we were late. But they sought and recovered those damages on behalf of their affiliates, which is why there's only two possibilities that we think are just. One is that they should actually be stopped from denying that they have at least an equitable interest of some sort in those turbines, because A, they didn't prove it, or B, that the affiliate should have been named as a party. There would have been no prejudice, no injustice, because they really did advance defenses that only were defenses that their affiliate had. The pre-lien notice defense on the basis of agricultural property is a defense of the affiliate, if the affiliate is the true tenant. These $300,000 worth of damages payable to the landlords are damages of the affiliate. They presented the defense and the claim in the case, and that is why the affiliate should have been.
But, I mean, you would agree, Mr. Hartnett, I mean, as the mechanics lien claimant, it's your obligation to establish that you served the right parties, and including the owner, right? I mean, that's how you get your fees.
Well, I guess I would say we had an obligation to serve an owner, which we believed we did on the basis of their representation.
I'm not so sure that's what the statute or the case law says. Dunham is a little different. I'll just say that for you.
If they have an ownership interest in the turbines and they fail to prove otherwise, then we did properly serve an owner. I know I only have a few minutes left, and I do want to touch briefly on the force majeure question. Right? That all of this, of course, is, you know,
dependent on whether we give them the liquidated damages.
Right. You know, we have no issue. We seek affirmance, but if for some reason you were accepting of the liquidated damage arguments, there were three separate bases for entitling us to time extensions that we think the district court erred, and of course force majeure being the most obvious one, including but not limited to, cannot be interpreted as a term of exclusion. And we should have been able to present our legitimate claims for time extensions, but again, that's only if the court were to reverse on the other basis for which the district court denied appellant's claims. I see that I'm out of time, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hartnett. Mr. Brown, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to make a few points on the lien issue. First of all, the district court made extensive findings in its order denying Rez's motion to amend or to add Stoneray Power Partners with respect to their reliance on any alleged misstatement that EDF made. The district court held conclusively that Rez was not justified in relying on anything that EDF said in its complaint, because Rez could have pulled the property records and apparently did pull the property records because they were able to identify Stoneray Power Partners. Nevertheless, they did not sue Stoneray Power Partners for reasons that we simply, we do not know what those reasons are. It's a regrettable error, but it was an error. I also want to address the alleged misstatement in the complaint. EDF represented that it was the owner of the project. EDF was the holder of the contract with Stoneray Power, or with Rez, and was the only party that had the contractual right to recover from Rez. It was a reasonable way to identify itself in its complaint. Third, I agree with you, Judge Connolly, that Rez had the burden to prove its ownership, to prove the ownership interest that EDF did or did not hold in these turbines. It was not EDF's burden to prove the converse.
How do you respond to the argument, though, that the only evidence of a transfer of the wind turbines to SPP was one person's testimony that was vague as to time? Why isn't it clear error by the district court in taking that one line of testimony and concluding the ownership issue?
Because it does not change the fact, Your Honor, that RES failed to meet their burden to show that EDF had an interest in the turbines at the time the foreclosure action was commenced. I also want to address this affiliate point.
They should have asked a follow-up question at trial, like, so when was the transfer?
They could have done that. They could have investigated in discovery and offered evidence of their own.
Never sent an admission. I understand what you said in the complaint, and you know, and you wrote a letter. But in the discovery, there's no admissions on this subject, is there?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
I didn't think so, but figured I'd put you on the spot.
The affiliate was not wholly owned and controlled by EDF, and there's evidence of this fact in the record. It was 5% owned by EDF's tax equity investor. So it was appropriate for the district court to hold that the affiliate, Stoneray Power Partners, had a due process right to defend itself. It's not the case that this is an alter ego of EDF, nor is there any evidence to that effect in the record. With respect to the leasehold on which Mr. Hartnett just relied, EDF's witness at trial did generally describe EDF as the holder of the leasehold, but simultaneously offered a copy of the lease in evidence which shows that EDF's affiliate, EDF Renewables, was the lessee on that lease. This was not a misrepresentation. I think to sum it up, EDF was the contractual counterparty of RES in this matter. For RES to rely on the fact that EDF sued RES for breach of contract here as the basis for the ownership interest it relied on in its liens was simply not a justifiable thing to do. Subject to any of the questions that the court has, I'll rely on my briefs for the remaining issues.
Seeing none, I think, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We will be getting out our decision within 90 days. So Mr.